Demigods and Supermen 277. Gods. When he has accomplished this, he is immortal, not absolutely in his own right, but in the immortality of the God from whom he is suspended. Immortality is consequently the merging of a mortal nature with an immortal nature, whereby the nature of the immortal is caused to extend and include the nature of the mortal. What was formerly impermanent thus becomes permanent by its mergence with the nature of permanence. Natures become immortal by retiring into their own causes, for causes partake of immortality and are proximate to the one cause toward which they themselves incline to partake of the fullness of being. Though men, the fractional parts, come and go and their span is but a little while, man, the principle, endures for an interminable period of time. By elevating themselves to wholeness, men are able to partake of the immortality of their archetype. Thus men and women as isolated personalities are not immortal, but their immortality is assured through their foundation in the causal nature. According to the ancients, the universe contains, in addition to the myriads of natural creatures, who inhabit its inferior part and are visible to the perceptions of the normal human being, other orders, hierarchies, or species of life beyond the perception of the limited faculties now at man's disposal. Socrates declares that there are orders of life which dwell along the shores of the air as men dwell along the shores of the sea. Dwelling in a subtler stratum, these beings are seldom given to contention, but live together in amity, worshipping the gods and serving the beautiful. To assume the visible to be the all is to deny even the most rudimentary instincts of human nature. Mankind dwells in a veil, as it were, and on every side rise high mountains which obscure from view that which lies beyond. Yet by what right shall we deny the existence of broader vistas beyond the CIR? Comes cribbing walls of our sense perception? Is it not reason able that the interval between wholeness and diversity is filled with a concatenated order of generations, some verging to ward wholeness and proximate to it, others verging toward diversity and filled with its quality? Degrees of wholeness are the spiritual impulses which manifest as the various genera composing physical life. There are degrees of wholeness requiring vehicles of expression far more refined than man's bodies, even as there are degrees of diversity, which like the grain of sand call for a structure less complicated. Are the gods then to be considered as arbitrary creations, or simply the hypothetical divisions erected by philosophy for the purpose of classifying the proximity of various natures, either to their substance or their shadow? Through the centuries, men have pleased to worship gods as proxies of the one indivisible and omnipotent nature. Being posterior to the one, are not the gods themselves natures? Though elevated to divine dignity from their proximity to wholeness, are they not, like men, orders of dependencies suspended in the abyss of interval, there to generate within their abundant natures a number iris progeny which they tolerate and ultimately cause to flow back again into themselves? Let the contemplation of divine natures, therefore, be a prouchet in the spirit of reasonableness, bereft of that awe and diffidence which has marked such contemplation in the past. Like the cyclopes, the wholes, or unities, stand regarding through their unified perceptions the transcendent nature of the first wholeness. An analysis of the natures of the gods is essential to an understanding of human nature, for through them we partake of the fullness of all good, and in them is the field of both our present labors and our future endeavors. Wholeness is not a personality. The gods, therefore, do not partake of the attributes of personalities. They are not vengeful principles, nor are they inclined to be moved by the piteous Supplication of the inadequate. Like the carved Ramses of Egypt, they sit immovable, sufficient, and all-sufficing. Of their immeasurable dignity we may not know all, but through philosophic discipline we may equip ourselves to understand, in part at least, the magnitude and tranquility of their avid ants. Regardless of the degree or dignity of the parts, the wholeness from which they themselves are directly suspended is there. 278 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. God, their father and their mother, their beginning and their end. Thus the gods are legion, merging into each other. These wholes verge toward their common first cause, and as the gods retire into God, so God, in turn, retires into that which was, is, and ever shall be, yet is not. The already well emphasized point that the gods are principles rather than personalities is confirmed by the evidence of Iamblichus, who attacked the concept popular among the uneducated masses that places could be assigned as divine habitats, or that certain communities enjoyed the patronage of the seals, tiles. One of the erroneous beliefs was that Athena Parthenos, Minerva, was the guardian spirit of Athens. Iamblichus aurea. Son thus, as the gods permeate the entire structure of being, and as universals are unlimited as to time and place, how can any locality be sufficiently private of their influence to require the appointment of a superessential protector? Being everywhere at all time and in all place, the gods are inherently omnipresent, nor can their influence be either increased or diminished. This theory is the rational foundation upon which must yet be erected the structure of universal religion. It unmasks the fallacious conceptions of racial or national gods. For it demonstrates that although men may differ concerning the attributes and number of their divinities, even attempting to distribute the universe among various deities, the divine principles themselves remain undivided and unchanged, with their presence equally common to all men and to all places. Iamblichus further likens the celestials and their abiding natures to the zodiac and the other heavenly bodies, whose influences, according to the astrologers, modeled side real and a tour into the tangible likenesses of various abstract qualities and conditions. As the stars abide in their enduring causes and are ever the same, so the gods abide upon their immovable thrones, for their unchangeableness is an essential attribute of their own divine natures. But as the mutual intermingling of the attributes of the abiding stars results in a countless order of diversified manifestations, so while the divine natures, the gods, remain unchanged, those participating in their manifold demigods and supermen. 279. 280 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. Virtues assume a variety of aspects to them and, dependent upon their proximity, which is measured by rationality, either enjoy the benevolent dispositions of these abiding divinities, or suffer from the deprivation of these influences. These relationships between abiding principles and non-abiding personalities are capable of measurement according to certain abstract principles, which the ancient philosophers concealed under the symbolism of time. These abstract mensurations, which must never be confused with literal calculations, are arcanely designated by the philosophers as the birthdays of the gods. Deities are said to be born at the moment when the unfolding rationality of the aspirant first participates in their effulgence or comes into harmonious correlation to their power. Thus the celebration of the divine birthdays does not signify that the deities were actually created upon these days, for if actually born they would thereby partake of the nature of generation and also be subject to the unstable laws of generation and decay. In Christianity, for example, Although the 25th of December is celebrated as the birthday of Christ, even the least informed layman knows that natus solis invicti signifies merely the descent of an eternal principle into the sphere of temporal agencies where the rationality of man may partake of its attributes and qualities. Christ is declared to have existed in the presence of the Father before the beginning of time, and after his death and resurrection to have reascended into the sphere of endurance, there to remain throughout all duration unaffected by time and not subject to the laws of incident and change. This concept is in harmony with the Platonic theory that the virtue of the immortals lies in the fact that they are unborn, having the apex of their period of activity posited in undivided unity or, as the Egyptians pleased to call it, unaging time duration that does not pass. In describing how inferior natures, or corporeal constitutions, become filled with the superabundance of celestial natures, thereby partaking of and manifesting the celestial sufficiencies, Proclus in his Theurgy, translated by Ficinus in his Excerpta, writes in substance as follows: as those who love gradually, Demigods and Supermen 281, advance from the admiration of sensible forms to the admiration of divine principles, so the initiated priests, discovering the sacred truth that all things subsist in all things, advanced from this conclusion to the fabrication of the sacred science, founded upon the principles of mutual sympathy and participation. Because of their understanding of the fourth dimensional universe, they realized that as far as the element of place is concerned, heaven was in the earth and the earth in heaven. That principles continually permeate both places and things. And that places and things endure their natural span immersed in the very substance of principle. Hence, the superior forever rules the inferior. Inferiors are ever paying homage to their superiors, either consciously, as in the case of illumined men, or unconsciously, as in the case of the elements, the latter voicing their admiration by assuming the appearance and reflecting the attributes of divine qualities. Thus, observes Proclus, the sunflower pays homage to the solar orb by inclining itself toward the source of its own being. A piece of paper, if preheated and then brought close to fire, will suddenly burst into flames even though it does not actually touch the fire. This is an arcane hint that divine natures, the fire, communicate themselves to such corporeal bodies, the heated paper, as have rendered themselves capable of their reception. The flaming paper further represents the deification of mortals whose divinity, by mingling itself with the causal flame, vanishes away into its own beginning, leaving naught behind but the ashes. The lotus also unfolds its petals with the ascent of the sun toward the zenith, closing its petals when the sun retires to the western corner of the heavens. This gesture of the plant is as much a hymn to the sun as the prayers and praise of men. Again, the sunstone imitates with its golden rays the luminosity of its namesake. Another curious gem, the eye of heaven has a form within it which resembles the pupil of the human eye and emits a brilliant ray. The lunar stone, by certain changes inherent to itself, also modifies its rays by the phases of the moon, and the stone called Heliozelenus changes its color with the celestial moods of